40s in central Iowa and Missouri to the mid-40s in Indiana. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, rain. It will be cooler, the high 50. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of showers, the low 40. The wind will be out of the north from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers are likely. Expect a high of 50. It will be windy. The wind will be out of the northwest at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy and windy with a chance of showers. We'll see a low in the upper 30s. The wind out of the northwest at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. Thursday, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers. Look for a high around 50. The wind will be from the northwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30 miles per hour. And the outlook for Thursday night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-40s to the low 50s. It was cloudy, with some locations reporting rain. Rockford and O'Hare reported 50 degrees at the top of the hour. It was 49 at Bloomington. In Mattoon and in Carbondale, light rain was reported, 46 at Mattoon, 48 at Carbondale. South Bend reported 50 degrees at the top of the hour. Lafayette, light rain and 48 degrees. Rain and 46 degrees at Indianapolis, and it was 46 degrees at Terre Haute. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky, 46 degrees at the top of the hour. The dew point, 42. The relative humidity, 86%. The wind out of the northwest at 3. The barometric pressure, 29.84 and steady. And at 12:39, 46 degrees in Urbana. Mark your calendars. The world is ending on October 21st. This announcement comes from Harold Camping, the doomsday prophet who said Judgment Day would come on May 21st, 2011. When the world did not come to an end, he recalculated. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
May 21st was supposed to bring a rolling earthquake that would devastate the world. That's what Harold Camping predicted. True believers would join Jesus in heaven, he said. Unbelievers would be tormented for the next 5 months. So when May 21 came and nothing happened, Camping had some explaining to do. 2 days later, the head of the Family Radio Network announced that he had been right about the date of God's wrath, just not about the method.
It was not a judgment day that was visible. It's a spiritual judgment day, but it is judgment day.
And he said, we're right on track for total earthly destruction on October 21st. Now, for some of Camping's followers, that was small comfort. Many had quit their jobs to spread the message, and others had given their life savings to family radio. When Camping was asked if he would return the money, he was unrepentant.
I don't have any responsibility. I can't be responsibility of anybody's life. I'm only teaching the Bible.
Camping had a stroke 18 days later. By September, he had recuperated enough to go on family radio with a modified prediction.
Probably there will be no pain suffered by anyone because of their rebellion against God.
Unbelievers might just fall asleep and never wake up. As for a violent upheaval?
The end is going to come very, very quietly, probably within the next month.
You'll note the word probably. Catherine Wessinger did. She's an expert on doomsday groups at Loyola University in New Orleans, and she says she's seen this before. When prophecy fails, she says,
the person making the prediction can give themselves a way out, sort of a backdoor way to get out of the original prediction. Or on the other hand, when nothing happens, the event can be spiritualized.
So in the days before October 21st, Camping's followers seem to be in a state of nervous anticipation.
Nobody has admitted defeat.
Brandon Tausig is a documentarian who's been following the movement. He visited Camping's church in California on Sunday, and he says it was full.
The congregation was still very much excited about the approaching date, and the sermon was entirely about October 21st, which really surprised me.
Mind you, he says, the church only holds about 100 people, and it's clear that the ranks of camping's true believers have thinned. One source says Family Radio is trying to sell off stations to avert bankruptcy. David Licori, who helped spread the news about May 21st last spring, admits that donations have plummeted.
The reputation of Family Radio is marred, and the money is not coming in.
Still, Licori believes the end is coming October 21st. He's just not sure what exactly it will look like.
Now, I don't know if God is going to destroy the world, burn the world with fire, but I know that the Bible uses that kind of language.
Licori won't say what he'll do if he wakes up on October 22nd, nor will Harold Camping, though he does say he's officially retired. Catherine Wessinger at Loyola says if past is prologue, a couple of things could happen. One is that the group could dissipate, or they could take a page from the Millerites. That group predicted that Jesus would appear in the 1840s. When he didn't, an event called the Great Disappointment, they reorganized and became the Seventh-day Adventists. No matter what, Wessinger says, doomsday movements will always be with us because they play into a primal fear.
We don't want to suffer, and we don't want to die.
And these movements give an escape. Next up, says Wessinger, December 21st, 2012, when the Mayan calendar seems to indicate the world will end again. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
As Europe's debt crisis drags on, the social safety nets in place in Eurozone countries are beginning to fray. One long-standing program, which is financed by the European Union and uses surplus food stocks, may end soon. The decision on whether to cut funding to the food aid program comes as more people join soup lines. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley begins her report at a food bank in Paris.
About 70 families show up every week to this food distribution center in the west of Paris. They receive staples like pasta, milk, meat, and canned goods. Fatima Balassi, who immigrated to France from Morocco 20 years ago, comes here once a month. Because of rising energy bills and a divorce, she says she can no longer feed her three children on a cleaning woman's salary.
But we get even more than food here. They help you mentally, they help with paperwork, they give you a lot of support.
As Belassi's three-year-old daughter Mona picks out a book from the center's library, the line outside the front door grows longer. Volunteers hand out canned goods and other foodstuffs. On the shelves are boxes marked European Community. French food charities get about a third of their supplies from the EU. The percentage is as high as 90% in other countries like Poland.
Every year in European agriculture, there are a certain amount of surplus. So the European Union decided to give it to the charity organizations.
That's Maurice Launy, president of the French Food Bank Association, explaining how the program got started 25 years ago. But Launy says EU farming is more efficient today and there are no more huge surpluses. Increasingly, the EU has been purchasing food to keep the $650 million a year program running, and some countries like Germany say that doesn't make sense. But proponents say only the program's legal status has to be changed to keep the food banks open. The 27 EU agriculture ministers will meet this week to decide on the program's fate, but it isn't looking good. Julien Lepretre is with the Secours Populaire Français, one of Europe's biggest aid groups.
If the decision is made to discontinue this program, people may not starve, but there will be millions threatened by malnutrition. 13 million people across the continent depend on this aid, and canceling it would be a disaster.
Lepretre says the financial crisis is also forcing more people to ask for help. Food banks like this one have long served single mothers and immigrants, but now the elderly and working poor are joining their ranks. 24-year-old Marc-Antoine Vadelorge is one of the new faces brought in by the crisis.
My name is Marc-Antoine Vadelorge. I come from Normandy. I'm a fisherman, and it's so hard now. All the price of the fish is down. The gas oil is up. I have made 10 days at 16 hours a day for 27 euro, you know. It's so hard.
Vadelorge left his family's fish business to come to Paris to look for work in restaurants. He says he never imagined he would end up having to use a food bank. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
America has a newly revised patent law. While supporters say the overhaul was long overdue, critics say it could spell catastrophe for startup companies and small businesses. Legal commentator Jay Kaysen has more.
On September 16th, President Obama signed the Leahy-Smith America Invents Act into law. This is the first major overhaul of patent law since 1952. That was 1 year before Watson and Crick proposed their double helix model for the DNA. Clearly, technology in various sectors and the world economic picture has changed a great deal since 1952. The volume and frequency of international trade has increased exponentially, and our reliance on technological innovation to solve human problems has never been higher. For the last 6 years, various stakeholder groups, such as the IT industry and the pharma and biotech industries, have been pushing hard for patent law reform. The hope now is that the new America Invents Act will streamline patent law to better address our 21st century needs. The most significant and controversial change to the patent system under the new law is the shift from a first-to-invent system to a first-to-file system. Under a first-to-invent system, the first person to actually come up with an invention is entitled to receive a patent, regardless of when they filed for their patent application. Under our new modified first-to-file system, the first person who files for a patent or the first person who discloses an invention wins and is entitled to a patent regardless of when they came up with the technology. The first-to-file system has long been the norm abroad, say in Europe or Japan. The advantage of a first-to-file system is that it creates a clear and certain rule to determine priority to an invention. Whoever is the first person to officially file for a patent has the first priority. On the other hand, under our former first-to-invent system, the process may be seen as being more just in its desire to reward the first and true inventor, but this came at the price of greater uncertainty, delay, and expense. The America Invents Act anticipates possible unfairness that may arise from a pure first-to-file system. For instance, if a university professor publishes her invention, or if an inventor publicly discloses his invention to see what the potential market might be for his technology, then in both situations, they still have 1 year to file for a patent application to protect their technology. In another benefit to universities, the new act reduces government patent filing costs for universities significantly. This is not to say that the America Invents Act removes all possible unfairness from a first-to-file system. For instance, even if you happen to be the first inventor of a technology, but you do not have the money or resources to file for a patent, you may be at a disadvantage compared to a second inventor in a large company that has the ability to get to the patent office before you. The new act also creates new mechanisms for anyone to challenge an issued patent through a post-grant review process that is very similar to patent opposition proceedings in Europe and Japan. These post-grant review mechanisms may result in higher quality patents being issued and may ensure that patent rights